Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Rene Harrop, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing tactics and fly designs for the Henry's Fork Toughest Trout. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Rene a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. Use the Q&A text box to send us your question. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. Content of this broadcast is copyrighted and the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc. doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Rene Harrop about fly fishing tactics and fly designs for the Henry's Fork's toughest trout. Rogue Orge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on Highway US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's Royal GorgeAnglers.com, or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. Well, before we introduce Rene, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in a drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Rene's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Rene's book, Learning from the Water, courtesy of Stackpole Books. Here's how you can win Rene's book. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills and see if you can't win that book. Now, it looks as though, folks, I was just getting ready to introduce Rene, and I just saw him drop off the line. So let me do his introduction, and we'll see if he gets reconnected here while I'm going through that. So tonight our guest is Rene Harrop, and Rene's interest in fishing started in 1954 when he was just 9 years old. His father started taking him to many of the fine rivers in the Yellowstone region where they explored and fished together. Rene fishes almost every day, sometimes just for a few hours, but he always manages to fish two or three full days each week. In 1968, Rene started fly tying commercially on a part-time basis, and within 3 years, built it into a full-time business, the House of Harrop. He was also a founding partner in the Trout Hunter, a lodge and fly shop located in Island Park, Idaho, which opened in 1998. Over the years, he has been a professional fly tier, artist, river guide, fly fishing consultant, and angling writer. Rene has been involved in many conservation endeavors and was a founding president of the Upper Snake River Fly Fishers and a founding member of the Henry's Fork Foundation. Rene's first book, Trout Hunter, was published in 2004 by Pruitt Publishing, and his most recent book, Learning from the Water, was published in 2010 by Stackpole Publishing. He also produced many DVDs, including Life Cycle of the Mayfly, Life Cycle of the Caddisfly, Tying with Turkey, and Favorite Flies. Rene's home water is the Henry's Fork, and his other favorites, the Madison, Firehole, Yellowstone, Gallatin, and South Fork of the Snake, are all within 3-hour drive. Rene, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thank you, Roger. It's nice to be with you.
Glad you got back on there. Well, told the folks, I said, oh, I'm just about ready to introduce him, and he just dropped off the line.
Well, I think there's a little distance between us, and we've got a pretty good snowstorm going on out here in Idaho right now, so maybe that played into it.
Yeah, well, we do, too. It just started a couple hours ago, and we need it. We're kind of short on snow up here in the Rockies.
Well,
Colorado,
that's kind of the way of it right now with us, but we're still okay, so, and it's early.
Well, good, good. Well, we're all set to go here, Renee. We've got lots of good questions, and I hope you're ready to talk about the Henry's Fork, flies, and all kinds of tactics that we can use to get connected with those fish. So let's dive in here. I want to talk a little bit about the Henry's Fork right off the bat here, and then we'll dive into food and flies, and I know that's an expertise that you have, especially in regards to the Henry's Fork, and then we'll talk about some of the tactics that you've used there. So we have an international audience here, and so I'd like you to explain where and what the Henry's Fork is and what role it plays in the western U.S. river systems.
Well, the Henry's Fork is located, its headwaters are located just outside the western boundary of Yellowstone, right where the states of Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho come together, and it drains into the Pacific as compared to, you know, the other side of the divide. We're right on the divide. So if you're on the Madison, which is not very much distance, probably 20 miles from the head of the Henry's Fork, you'd be in another complete drainage going to the Atlantic. So that's where it begins. It runs about 60 miles south, almost due south to its confluence with the South Fork of the Snake River. Its role as a fishery is one of quite well-known prominence. It's primarily noted as a dry fly stream because of its many buried hatches, mayflies, caddis, all the aquatics plus nice variety with terrestrials as well. I compare it to no other river that I've ever fished because of the nature of its slow-moving character, at least in the water that most people are familiar with, and that's the fly-only water in the area of Island Park, which most people would think of when they think of the Henry's Fork of the Snake.
Yeah, so, and you just said it, Henry's Fork of the Snake, so it's actually one of the forks of the Snake River, which is a huge waterway that, like you said, goes all the way to the Pacific. So, and the other fork, the South Fork of the Snake, is also very popular and well-known.
You're absolutely right, and they're located about an hour and a half apart in drive time, and they're very, very different in their, the size, the character, but both are, tremendously productive trout streams, and each possesses its own quite distinct personality.
Now, what if we're going to fish the Henry's Fork? What species of fish are sought after there?
The native species of the Henry's Fork, as far as trout, are the Yellowstone cutthroat, and in some areas of the river, they're faring quite well. It's mostly the upper reaches, Henry's Lake, and the Henry's Lake outlet, as it's called. The other native game fish is the Rocky Mountain whitefish, probably not as popular, but a nice trout that takes a dry fly really willingly. I think the most famous trout of the Henry's Fork, or the trout that it's most noted for, the big rainbows that that live in the area, especially downstream from Island Park Reservoir, and from there on down to below Mesa Falls, where brown trout, more recently introduced, perhaps maybe 35 years ago, joined the other three species. And you'll also find a few brook trout, just remnants of hatching eryx, stockfish, hatchery fish that are placed into the tributaries periodically.
Well, now, are the rainbows, cutthroats, and browns that are in the Henry's Fork now, are they all wild trout, or are they stocking that as well?
There's no direct stocking into the main stem. It's anything that falls outside the description of wild trout, as I said, would come from any of the dozens and dozens of tributaries, which some, and Roger, I don't even know. the stocked trout other than Henry's Lake, where they have a program that with a hatchery right on site, is really the only prominent stocking activity. And those are fish that are coming directly from the river, spawned out, and return back to the from the lake, went back into the lake. So essentially, I consider the Henry's Fork to be a wild trout fishery.
Okay, okay. Can you kind of give us, you've talked about a couple of sections of the river already, but I was wondering if you could give us a kind of tour from, you know, the headwaters, which is Henry's Lake, correct?
Yes.
Down to where most people would, you know, fish and you know, where the cutoff point would
right,
be.
Right, right. Yeah, briefly, the main source of the Upper Henry's Fork is the Big Spring, which lies right at the base of the Moose Creek Plateau. It's a beautiful spot. You know, it's a full-blown spring creek, bubbles right up from the ground, constant temperature, 52 degrees. I would estimate the volume being probably 200 to 300 CFS. Downstream slightly, it's joined by Henry's Lake Outlet, which is, it varies because it's a working stretch of water where the storage in the water for irrigation dictates its flow, whereas the Spring Creek doesn't receive any manipulation and flows. From that point, it flows down about 10 miles, forms the Island Park Reservoir, and at the bottom of the Island Park Reservoir, the top of the most important water, I think, would be considered Box Canyon. It flows directly out of the reservoir. It's narrow, quick-moving water. Really, a contrast to what it becomes approximately 5 miles downstream. In the area of Last Chance, which is where Bonnie and I spend our summers, about half the year actually, the river widens and flows through the Harriman State Park. This is a famous fly-only water, and this is, again, that's the most recognized portion of the Henry's Fork. It stretches for approximately 8 miles. Down to an area called Riverside, and there again the river narrows up, quickens, flows for about a dozen miles, and it drops about 105 vertical feet of the upper Mesa Falls, and followed by a secondary fall of about 65-70 feet directly downstream, and it's rapids, fast water, kayak type water if you're especially brave. From that point, it runs 15 miles downstream and it opens up into the Snake River Plain. And you've left public land, Forest Service, BLM land, and move into privately owned property when the river flows out onto the plain there, so to speak. It's agricultural land primarily, and in the course of its travel from its beginnings, it's collecting constantly moderately large and some very small tributaries, but collectively it creates a much larger river than where we fish it there in Last Chance in the fly-only water. It's a wonderful fishery. There's a smaller lake called Ashton Reservoir and a tailwater directly beneath or below that stretch of water, and tremendous fishing. Different character. Larger water is the main difference, but it has good hatches and again large rainbow and some surprising. Well, I shouldn't say surprisingly, brown trout. They grow large wherever they are, I think. But it varies considerably from, you know, from top to bottom. It's a very diverse river. By the time it finally terminates the South Fork, downstream from a town called Rexburg, here in the Lower Valley.
So really, there's fishing to be done all the way to, it sounds like a tailwater, but below Ashton.
Yes, it's as productive probably as any stretch of the river, larger and less accessible perhaps because of the nature of the private property that surrounds it, that borders the river. But yes, and the river does, because of a variety of influences, agricultural use. You run into some thermal problems as the elevation drops, and it's typical of many of the rivers that form in you know, the high country and then drain downstream into lower elevations. But there are trout all the way from its beginning to its end, and it's a matter of, you know, just picking the type of water you want to fish and the type of fishing you want to do. So, the Henry's Fork is a really diverse river.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And you said, when you talked about the spring at the headwaters, are you talking about a spring that actually fills Henry's Lake, or is the spring above Henry's Lake?
No, and I'm sorry if I didn't make myself clear. It's a separate source of the river. It's the main source. The river does, I mean, it emerges, you know, as a full-blown spring creek, and then flows perhaps maybe 2 miles before it's joined by the outlet from Henry's Lake. So Henry's Lake provides the source of water. It's the next tributary of the Henry's Lake outlet.
Yeah, I guess my map is not detailed enough. It just shows that, you know, it looks like it's just coming out of Henry's Lake, so I was trying to figure out where the spring was in relationship to that. So so it really is, it is a spring creek at the upper end above Island Park, and then starts to change character as we go down with some, sounds like some tailwater sections and some freestone type sections as well.
Right, and you add the impoundments as well with the two lakes, or excuse me, the two reservoirs, not including Henry's Lake, but, you know, that are on the actual main stem of the river. So, yeah, it has all those features.
Yeah, I know when you're talking about big browns, I know my first experience with the Henry's Fork was picking up a brand new boat from Hyde in Island Park and then giving it its first run on the Henry's Fork. And I remember it obviously wasn't fly-only area, but I think our put-in was somewhere around, I don't know, 17. Is Upper Mesa Falls, is there an impoundment right there where there's a falls and a put-in right below? This was right below a falls.
Below a falls. I'm guessing that you would probably have been down in what we call the Warm River, the Ashton stretch, which is several miles downstream from Mesa Falls, yes.
Hmm. Well, anyway, when we were putting it in, some guy was spin fishing in the deep water right at the base of the falls and pulled in, I think it was a 24-inch brown trout right there, while we were putting our boat in. Needless to say,
well,
we got excited. So, I know that was the first fish I saw out of the Henry's Fork. It was a huge brown. So. Very exciting.
Well, the method of fishing isn't regulated, or restricted to fly fishing, other than just essentially in the water from through the actual Harriman State Park, the Harriman, the old railroad ranch. It is artificial lure for most of the river downstream, but when you get down to the lower end, I also should mention, is catch and release for the first. About 12 to 15 miles, but when you get down into that lower area where you launched your boat on its maiden voyage, the other methods are allowed. But primarily, you're going to see fly fishermen there. It's not the most popular location for methods other than fly fishing, and I think that's because it has its identity there, but it offers a, you know, opportunity for families as well. And I don't lament too much the more liberalized nature of the regulations downstream. This Henry's Fork has always been a river that essentially protects itself. So in that regard, we're still okay.
Now, talking about floating, what sections are floatable with a drift boat or a raft, and what sections are weight only, would you say?
Well, we'll start with the drifting, and as I mentioned, you're going to want to be very, very cautious if this is your first time, if you're going up all alone, because there are some very hazardous stretches from the extreme of the two large falls, Mesa Falls, Upper and Lower Mesa Falls, above Island Park Reservoir. It flows very gently for a considerable distance, and then just a short distance before it enters Island Park Reservoir, there's a place called Coffee Pot Rapids, and very, very hazardous. And so, and again, both above and below Mesa Falls is essentially whitewater. It's not water that a beginning or less than experienced river man would want to undertake. So, you know, make sure before you embark on a float trip, you're getting good information on the character of the river and the safety that's involved there. The majority of the rest of the river is floatable, certainly Box Canyon through Harriman and down to an area that I mentioned called Riverside, about 15 miles below Last Chance, is all floatable. But it's a good way to access, especially for older people or people that are handicapped in any regard physically, to access water you either float it or you have to walk it or bicycle it. That's another way of accessing it. But those areas are pretty comfortable and don't require, you know, the highest skill in oarsmanship. And then down on the lower end, there isn't really the hazards, I would say, is missing a takeout perhaps, and then having to drift, another 10 miles or so beyond your destination. I would qualify it by saying there are some diversion dams down in the Chester area between Ashton and St. Anthony, two different sections where water is diverted into a canal system. So, and there are sheer, you know, they're low falls, but they are coming off impoundments. So again, make sure that if you're going to be floating, get good information before you launch your boat.
Right. So what would you say are the usual put in and take out points that people use?
I'd say the most accessible and easy to reach and also the most productive water. I'd start with Box Canyon, directly below Island Park Dam. There's another, there's a takeout and a put in right at the bottom of Box Canyon. It's about a 5 mile float downstream from the dam. That will take you to, where Highway 20 crosses the Henry's Fork, I'd say approximately 4 to 5 miles downstream from there. That stretch would take you through the Harriman Ranch, at least the upper Harriman Ranch. Now from that point, if you're floating through the ranch, you take out right at the Osborne Bridge, or if you want to float to lower water, you would put in at that point, again at Osborne Bridge, and you would float to Riverside Campground. Both floats are about equal, I'd say 6 to 8 mile floats. Downstream from there, the access there just below the mouth of Warm River, where Warm River, which is a sizable stream, joins the Henry's Fork. There's a nice public access there that will take you through about a 10 mile float. I'm approximate guess here is what I'm doing with this to the top of Ashton Reservoir, and then which is again an impoundment. That's a very pronounced float. Downstream from Ashton Dam, there's another public access at what they call Ora Bridge, and that's directly below the Ashton Dam. It flows a fairly short distance to the next public access and boat launch facility. It's perhaps 4 miles. There, just below Vernon Bridge, is the next public access, and that flows from Vernon Bridge to just above Chester Dam, which is one of those low diversion dams that you want to be watching for, because the boat launch area there is directly above the fall. So
you miss it, you go over, huh?
I'm sorry?
You miss the takeout and you go over the dam, it sounds like. Huh?
Well, and you know, then it's very deceptive, because if you look at it, it's very, very flat. It's almost, very slow-moving current, and it's right at the confluence of where Fall River comes in as well. But you want to be alert, because if you're not aware of what lies beyond that flat surface, about a 12 or 15 foot drop. But again, this is of what we were talking about when you're investigating, is get all the information you can and
sure.
To be watching out for hazards. The next section that you would actually drive below, just a few hundred yards below the dam, you can relaunch your boat, or you know, it's not a takeout since it's directly below the dam, but you can float from Chester Dam to an area they call Fun Farm. and that's just above St. Anthony. And you know, we could take it on down the river, but I think if you terminate it at the Fun Farm, you're hitting, you know, virtually, you know, the best water that
right.
you're going to find.
Right.
Water below there, you know, you may gain a little more solitude, but the trout population, the hatches, and a lot of the things, a lot of the features that we have upstream from there are not as, you know, not as impressive, let's put it that way.
Right, right. Well, Renee, we need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the Henry's Fork, and then we'll talk about equipment, food, and flies. So hang tight with me. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com. That's dryflies.com. And you can view the fishing products and guide services they offer in both Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Renee Harrop about fly fishing tactics and fly designs for Henry's Fork's toughest trout. If you'd like to ask Renee a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Renee, at this point in the show, I always ask my guests what's going on in their fly fishing world, so tell us what's going on.
Well, we're at the point of the year when talking about fly fishing is probably the closest that we're going to get to, you know, at least here locally, to actually fishing. We've had some unusually cold weather, so here on the lower river where we have a year-round season on ice in the river, and we've had temperatures, you know, considerable number of days of sub-zero temperatures, and things slow down a little bit, and you know, for the younger party person, which I am neither anymore at 66 years of age, you could still get out there and, you know, and probably have some fun with, you know, doing some nymphing and some streamer fishing in the areas that are quicker moving areas where icing isn't a factor. But for the most part, as a fisherman, I'm restocking fly boxes. Looking forward to maybe a little break in the temperature when some midges will be floating on the surface. I can get a little work out there, and with the holiday season around, we're looking at a lot of good family time. I have a fly fishing family, so we have a lot of fun. I'm bringing grandkids up, so we're doing knot sessions and, you know, the kind of things that a grandpa and now a great grandpa can do. So. It's a nice time of year. It's really a pretty good contrast for the busy season when, you know, when you're going nonstop and fishing every minute that you can. But still, I'll be ready to go as quick as there's a window.
Now, you know, we mentioned in your introduction about your latest book, Learning from the Water. And you've got another book and also some DVDs and so forth. If people are interested in that, where would they go? Do you have a website that they could visit to get those products?
Yes, thanks for asking. We have a website. It's House of Harrop at fairpoint.com.
That would be your email address.
Excuse me. The email address is HOH. That's Fairpoint. That's www.houseofherb.com. Okay, that's it.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
Right there.
Gonna,
yeah.
You know, when we talked earlier, Roger, I depend on my right arm to handle these things.
Right.
You have me on the phone longer than most people will in a month.
Okay, so houseofherb.com is where people can find out about your books and other things going on in your fly fishing world, right?
Yeah, yeah. It describes. We have a, my family is a business house of Harrop is a, has a custom fly tying service, and we have a few other items as well. The books and you know the videos, DVDs are available there as well.
Great, great, terrific. Well, let's dive back in here. Quick question about public versus private water. It kind of sounded like there was a lot of public water there. Is it? Can you kind of explain that? Because water rights are always an issue when we, you know, move.
Well, yes, and that kind of goes hand in hand with you know the need to again. I'm speaking to the visitor or the first time visitor, the you know the less experienced person in this area, and that is that. While the Henry's Fork does enjoy a sizable percentage of its flow is, you know, flows through public land, and access is, you know, is not as restricted as it is, you know, through the public, or excuse me, the privately owned land. But, for example, the upper area, again, the fly only water, the Harriman area is accessible, the river itself is accessible only by foot or bicycle, and there are some sections of the river in that area that have development. There are some subdivisions, some summer home that have been constructed there. Those are you know those are private property, but still, I consider the access to be you know to be quite good in you know in terms of the. What has been provided is launching points, parking areas, et cetera, where even though you may not be able to drive right to the river, you can, you know, find a place to park and launch your boat or, you know, if you're walking or waiting, particularly in that upper end. Downstream, it gets more restricted because of, again, it's agricultural land and, as the interest in fly fishing and as here on the Henry's Fork has increased and the, you know, the volume of the traffic is, has increased. It has created some conflict with, you know, with parking and vehicle problems with some of the landowners there. And so, you will be restricted to those access points where the launches are, provided, boat launching is provided and also parking. But it's, you know, it's convenient for, or inconvenient from the standpoint that you may have to walk a little bit further, but I think that, you know, if you're waiting and not floating, and you know, it's always good to, you know, to work the edge of the river, and I spend a lot of time doing that. I actually prefer, you know, walking the banks when I can and, you know, looking for big trout.
Now, what are the actual, laws concerning, the riverbank? You know, like in Montana, you have, up to the high water line,
and that applies to navigable streams, and that's consistent with what we have here on the Henry's Fork and its tributaries. Yes, yes. You're not going to get you know in too much problem just walking. You know, close to the river, you don't want to be wandering out in the livestock or yeah, in the fields. But it's rare that you're going to be having difficulty with, you know, with a landowner if you're not parking in the wrong place, you know, obstructing his access to his fields or his equipment or, you know, that sort of thing. So, yeah, keep as close to the, you know, to the water's edge as you can. And,
okay.
I don't think you're not going to have too much problem.
And it sounds like, this is very fishable without a guide. But I would imagine
you know. Yes. I think you know most people would get along just fine. You know, it's like any river, any water that you fish. You need a little time to you know to get acquainted with it, with its rhythms and its you know its character. You know, it's the character of the river, but. You know, if you're there at a good time of year, and the best time of year is always when we have the dry fly fishing, in my opinion, and that's not to say that, you know, there aren't other ways to enjoy the Henry's Fork, but, trout have preferences, and, you know, if you can read the water a little bit and keep your eyes open for, you know, for rising trout, you should have some success.
Now, John Elmer in New York wrote in, and he asked, is Rich Paney as good as he say is? And Rich is one of the guides up there on the river, right?
Well, I don't know who they are and how good they say are, but Rich Caney is one of the co-owners of Trout Hunter, the business that I've been involved with for.
Oh, so you're a little partial to him, huh?
Yeah.
That's a loaded question.
Yeah, it is, and I think somebody's probably pulling my leg a little bit.
No, okay.
He's a fine young. He's a fine young angler, and I've known him since he was a college student doing intern work for the Henry Swart Foundation, and he has 20. Right around 20 good years under his belt as a guide and an outfitter and a fly shop owner. And, and he gets around. He's a talented young man and bright and very, very accomplished both in fresh and salt water. And, I'd have to add that, the question would be, is Millie Paney as good as they say she is? That's his wife. They're a young couple with a little daughter, Ella. And, they're very impressive.
Good. What section of the river would you consider your favorite section to fish?
Oh, gosh. Oh, it's such a wonderfully entertaining river. I love the fly only water, the water between Last Chance, including Last Chance, and a little area they call Pine Haven. I love the delicate dry fly and the big selective trout, and it's a comfortable stretch of the river too. It's quite wide in many places, but it's comfortable to wade and a lot of open water. It's accessible. You can walk the banks for miles, and I can't imagine a more satisfying piece of water to fish than that area I just described.
Now, is the Henry's Fork a year-round fishery, or is it closed?
Essentially, it is. The fly-only water in Harriman and again, down in the Pine Haven area, the lower Harriman area, and down through Pine Haven, does have a seasonal closing, and there's a closed area, the big spring that I talked about, which is the main source of the river and its headwater. It's closed all the time. There's no fishing allowed, and there are a bunch of big fish that people can go and watch, and they have some fish food there that you can tempt them up with. But really, the majority of Henry's Fork is open year-round. And, again, check the regulations, or you can contact any of the several fly fishing outfitters and fly shops that can keep you in line in that regard.
So, and it sounds, and I know for a fact, because when we got our boat up there, I think it was April or something, and up by Island Park, there was still like 3 feet of snow up there. So,
you do get winter up there. Yes, we do have winter, and that's the limiting factor in wintertime. And this is only the second year that some of that water has been open to year-round fishing. For example, Box Canyon down through Last Chance to the top of Harriman, the Harriman Ranch was opened as of last year to year-round fishing. And part of it, because it's in the Box Canyon, for example, is really tough to get through when you have 6 feet of snow, which is not uncommon. In fact, that's probably just an average snowpack or snow accumulation,
right,
in midwinter up there. But downstream from there, even here in St. Anthony, which is 2,000 feet lower in elevation or approximately that, but we still get 3 feet of snow as a general rule.
Right.
So, getting to the river is the biggest limitation in the winter times.
Let's talk about equipment for a little bit. If one was a new visitor to the Henry's Fork, what weight and length rod would you suggest for the Henry's Fork for most conditions?
My personal preference for the majority of fishing I do is a 9-foot four weight. I can handle the majority of the flies until we start getting into the, you know, the bigger stuff, you know, the bigger flies and the bigger water where you need to get a little more muscle going. But I think most people would probably get along maybe a little better with a 5-weight, 9-foot rod, something in that area. But, and I do rely on that for some of the bigger water, but day in and day out, I'm fishing a 9-foot 4-weight.
Okay. And, do you fish a majority of the river with floating line, or is there ever a need for sinking tip or intermediate sinking lines?
With the exception of some of the stringer fishing I do mainly in the fall and in the off season, it's floating line, and I would use an intermediate sinking line for some of the stringer fishing, and particularly on the lower river.
Okay. This might take a while, so this next question. So I'm going to take a quick break here and then come back and ask you about your terminal tackle. So we'll be right back and talking with Renee Harrop in just a few minutes. Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters, or salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's www.womensflyfishing.net. Or call Pudge at 907-274-7113. It's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Renee Harrop about fly fishing tactics and fly designs for Henry's Fork's toughest trout. If you would like to ask Renee a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. We got a question in on the Internet here, Renee, and it's from Kyle in Tulsa. He says, in your newest book, Learning from the Water, you talk about leaders that you build yourself. What is your favorite brand of material to use for this, and what color? And maybe you can just kind of expand upon that and, you know, talk about built leaders and commercial leaders and what you're using now.
Well, that's one of my favorite subjects. I've put a lot of attention and effort and experimentation into leaders, and it's my opinion that, you know, a good leader can really spell the difference between being effective and not so much, especially on the really demanding water that, you know, that we have in the fly only water, and really what the Henry's Fork is known for, and which is, you know, smaller dry flies and nymphs, of course. I'm an advocate of using the longest leader that you can handle, and obviously that's going to be, you know, a matter of personal preference, along with, you know, your ability to, you know, to cast a longer leader. For me, I would consider a 16-foot leader about the average leader that I would use. In other words, that would kind of be my starting point, and I would work maybe, you know, a couple of feet longer and backward a couple of feet too, where I'm going from, you know, 16 to 18, sometimes even 20 on the long end when things are particularly difficult, and that's usually low water, real clear conditions, that sort of thing. And when I move backward, it's to accommodate wind and larger flies, you know, the type of fishing, the type of cast that I'm going to be wanting to make as well. But I developed over a considerable number of years a taper that really functions well, and I would describe it, you know, as essentially an extension of the line. So it's an aggressive taper, and to make it aggressive, if you're building your own, you have to make very careful measurements in the graduations of the sections of leader that you incorporate into the taper as you're moving from the butt section down to the tippet. And they're, as I get into the main taper, the sections are pretty close together. In other words, and I don't vary the diameter by more than 1/1000th of an inch. So, you know, even though there are plenty of formulas that say, well, you know, you can use 2/1000ths and still retain good performance and knot strength, I don't go that route. The material I really like is, you know, in fact, I'll probably have to give our trout hunter a little bit of a plug because the timing of the question, you know, just lines up with a new program that we just brought online about not quite 2 years ago, where we began importing from Japan a very, very high quality material that that I do use in both the construction of my hand tapered leaders or hand tied leaders and the tip as well. It's very, very good stuff, let's put it that way. And along with that, we've been finally, after years and years of hoping and trying to get some progress made in the ability of technology to duplicate some of these, you know, these high performance leaders, and I think there are others as well. Maybe they're old timers like me who still retain that that connection to, you know, to the these fine tuned leaders. But Trout Hunter does have a very functional and efficient 14-foot leader and a knotless taper that duplicates the specifications of my original leader design. And so I'm pretty happy to report that I'm no longer forced to, you know, to make leaders. And when you have as many grandkids and family that fit all on it, want one of those special leaders, it's lightened my load considerably when it comes to leaders.
Yeah, so no more tying all those blood knots.
Well, yeah, that's essentially it. But no, I won't say that now and again. I won't tie one up. But I think it's a good skill to have. But as I said before, we've had such, you know, wonderful advancements in tackle, in all aspects of tackle, and I consider this, you know, what we've been able to accomplish, and I'm talking about the Trout Hunter program, and this is a pretty personal thing for me, because as I said, it's something that I'd hoped for many years, because I know how helpful a leader that really performs correctly can be to, especially in the type of fishing that we're talking about when we're talking about a Henry's Fork.
So if people wanted to find out more about that, they could go to trouthunter.com. Is that?
That's right.
Okay. Yeah, and look for leaders there. Good.
Right.
Okay, and now it seems to me I read somewhere, I don't know if it was in your book or your notes to me, that you actually prefer fluorocarbon nowadays to mono. Is that still the case?
I do, and there's a, you know, there's a practicality that applies here. You know, I'll begin by saying that I'm very conscious of the nature of fluorocarbon and its as compared to nylon, and you know, in its that it doesn't degrade as quickly. So I'll begin by saying that I acknowledge that and consider that in all things. But in my experience, and having used, you know, every type of tip of material, that's what we're talking about. Again, this newer fluorocarbon is for large trout, and that's a thing we haven't touched on. But you know, it's quite a unique thing to be fishing, you know, size 22 dry flies to, you know, almost routinely to trout in the 20 to 24 inch range, and expecting to have some chance of landing them, and that's the basis of my preference, and it's as simple as that.
Now, we did get a follow-up question here on the internet about the fly-only area. What area was that? And that was Harriman Park, correct?
Yes.
Harriman State Park. That's your fly-only area for.
Yes.
For
yes.
Joel, who was that?
Yes, yes, Joel. That's the only specifically fly-only water. Although upstream and downstream of that water, Box Canyon, the last chance is artificial lure and no kill, and as well as the fly-only water is No Kill, and then directly below Harriman for to Riverside Campground, to Riverside Access, it's artificial lure, flying artificial lure only in No Kill. So that's regulations that, that kind of differ from what you described earlier when you encountered the folks with the
right.
with the brown trout.
Yeah, and they killed it too, by the way. So.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk a little bit here, Renee, about food and flies on this river. Richard Rupp asks, what's the most consistent hatch on the river? What's the most prolific and most prolific hatch on the river?
That's an interesting question. I think that like many waters here in the Rocky Mountain West, that betas, if you consider the entire year, are the most numerous and most consistent, and typically they're quite small. Now that doesn't mean that they're going to be the most important or the most interest to the trout, but we call them blueling olives, although they'll vary in color. There's a lot of tan, a lot of gray that comes into play, but the betas, I would say, are the most consistent throughout the entire year. Now the most prolific hatch in terms of the main season, and I would put the main season from during the months of July through really through September anymore. It used to be August, but people have found that fall is a nice place to be on the nice time to be on the water. I consider, at least on the Henry's Fork, the pale morning duns to be the hatch. They're the hatch that appears virtually every day. They're the green drake and the brown drakes, the larger flies. A variety of other flies are larger and get the trout pretty excited, but they're short term in their appearance. Seldom, maybe 2 weeks maybe on the long end for those bigger mayflies, whereas the pale morning duns will hatch essentially every day through 3 to 4 months.
So would you consider Dennis in Colorado Springs wants to know, what's your favorite mayfly hatch to fish? Would it be the pale morning dun?
Well, yeah. And there's a variety of reasons for that. It's in the book I call it the defiant hatch because of its duration and the fact that the trout are seeing it every day. It just becomes more and more difficult as the season progresses, and because those trout are getting attention, fishermen attention every day. They, they see all these great patterns, and they just become brutally difficult to fool. The way they can, separate the real thing from the imitation is just remarkable. And of course that, with a fly tyer and a person who loves the challenge, I can become almost obsessed by that hatch.
What are some of the other important hatches that you would consider that one should be prepared for?
Caddis are, they're a staple, in various sizes and colors, et cetera, through the spring, summer, and early fall. So, you want to be prepared for, for a variety of different caddis hatches. And some of the more important mayflies, you don't forget those big patches of brown drakes and green drakes are size 10 flies, and we call them, most of the other flies, squin flies, because they're 18 and smaller and considerably smaller in some instances. The gray drake's another one. It's a slightly smaller and not as reliable perhaps as the green and the brown drakes, but one of my favorite hatches, mainly because it rescues me on some of these days when, the pale morning duns are just brutal, and I'm, taking the short end of the stick when it comes to getting a lot of business done with this hatch, and that's the flat hatch, and that's we call it the small western drake, and it's about a size 14. Nice olive fly, tall wing, dark wing, and the trout just love that fly, and I don't know how to explain why they can be so enthusiastic. And they'll mix with a PMD hatch, and you know, just be just tremendously selective to the PMDs, and they see one of those flabs, and they just jump on it. And it's a hatch of significant duration. Usually a month, if you consider the lower river even longer, mid-June through, we can even see them as late as early August. And, you know, it's a really nice hatch, and the trout love that fly. So, I wouldn't hesitate to put that on my calendar if I was looking for a hatch to base my visit on. The trichos, they speak for themselves. They're tiny. They're, produce all the difficulty, but also, a lot of the real satisfying dry fly fishing that we have, because they're consistent early in the mornings. And the Calabasas, the Henry's Fork is one of the few rivers that I've fished moving water stretches. It has a serious Calabasas hatch, and that's a nice 16, size 18 mayfly, and it's a nice mid to late summer hatch. There's a nice March brown in the evening. We call it a March brown. It's a good sized fly, 14, 16, that hatches earlier in the year. And again, there's always the betas. So there's I could probably name two or three others that of probably lesser importance that you would probably want to be prepared for. But I think those flies cover the most important aquatic hatch. Midges are important too, but usually on the shoulder of the season, early and late, and winter time.
Mm-hmm. Martin Coleman in Lawrence, Kansas, wants to know what are the top five flies you would put in your box to fish the Henry's Fork?
Well, after going through that,
I know you have a lot of boxes. So.
I have a lot of boxes.
This is a tough question, but.
Well, it's a fair question too. I know that not everyone is as extreme as I am when it comes to the flies, but there is a handful of patterns, and I think I could probably come up with the five flies. I know there's a chapter in Learning from the Water that I talk about eight flies that I think are worth carrying, and they're selected for their versatility. And if I can even stretch that list to five to eight, because remember those. I like the olive tailwater, CDC tailwater special, a black CDC bubbleback caddis. The tailwater special, I carry that in size 12 through 18. The bubbleback cat is 14, 20. I like a CDC line true, size 12 through probably 18. I throw a nymph in there because I do carry nymphs, and I do enjoy selective nymphing. A turkey tail nymph, and that's one that they can find in the book as well. And it's similar to a pheasant tail, but it's different colorations tied in the same style, but using turkey tail fibers as compared to the ringnet as the pheasant tails for the tail for the fly, for the fibers for the fly, 12 to 20. I wouldn't be without a CDC rusty para spinner in a variety of sizes, 12 on down to probably 22. CDC Adams by a parachute, 12 through 22. A black beetle, CDC beetle, I carry, a good black beetle pattern, 12, I guess, down through size 18. Another terrestrial I really like is a black CDC flying ant, size 12 through, or 14 through 22. And these are flies selected for, I'm sorry?
I think you're into box two now. You sure that was on?
Well, these are flies that that can give good service for the 4 months that we're going to be having hatches.
Yeah.
And it is geared to that. You're going to want hoppers in season and things like that, of course. But most people are going to have that. But that's a pretty good list of patterns I think I would carry. And these are my flies, my patterns. So I'd probably be more helpful if I wasn't being as limited in that description, but
yeah, Yeah. Some of those that you mentioned, though, the basic flies, the parachute atoms, beetles, and ants.
Yeah.
You know, those are standbys almost no matter where you go. You know.
I agree. I agree.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk about. And here Jeff Biller in Hunlock Creek, Pennsylvania, says, I know from reading your great books that you have a small fly shop of flies you carry with you. He says, I'm heading to your second week of July. What patterns would you never go without? So we kind of covered that, but I thought his comment of a small fly shop of flies. But talk about how many boxes of flies you take on the river. And how you've organized those, because I think that would be useful to folks.
Well, there's a chapter in Learning from the Water that addresses that rather remarkable subject, at least it applies to me, and it's called a working fly box. And in that chapter, I describe how my flies are organized into systems, whereby many times I will select a particular hatch. Let's take PMD, for example, because, it lasts for so long and I go through so many flies. But I'll cover, the full cycle, the life cycle of the fly with the patterns I carry in that. And that's the way I approach it, in order to keep it, again, because I carry, more than a dozen fly boxes almost all year long. Although as my back gets older, that number starts to become problematic. But that's what I would recommend to anyone who wants to have quick access to their flies and be able to know what they have available when they go to the water. In the years when I was just putting them in compartments and they're all mixed up and unorganized, I found myself frequently fighting to try to find the right fly and losing good fishing time for that. So I think overall the organization of flies visibly organized in an orderly row of the wonderful fly boxes we have now is really helpful. excuse me. Now, specific to the question, I'm forgetting the gentleman's name. The early July. The Henry's Fork at that time. I'll go through it very quickly. I would say you want green and brown drakes, size 10. You want some flabs, 14, 16, of course the PMDs, black beetles and flying ants. Black flying ants are flies that, of course, you'd have anyway, I guess. And at that time, we start seeing a few calibatus as well. So I'd say that would be a good base, basic selection. And if you're tying for that, and then, I'd go prepared to either tie, in your camp or, when you're on site as well, because it seems like there's always something that pops up that's different from last year, different from what's being recommended, and there are a lot of good fly shops, in the area, too, that can help folks out.
Okay. Randy in Inglewood, Colorado, wrote in, he said, when you're designing a fly pattern to solve a hatch, what are the top 3 to 5 steps you go through in making a design?
Gosh. I think that's almost impossible to answer because, if there are things that I'm going to be emphasizing, I think that we have to begin with making sure that the size is correct. Knowing the size of the insect you're trying to imitate is as important as any factor in a good fly, whether it's a known fly or a new fly that you're trying to develop. The shape of the fly, the overall appearance, the physical appearance of the fly. Give attention to each body component and try to duplicate the actual insect in terms of the volume of material that you're applying. Most flies that don't produce the results we're hoping for are overdressed. They're too many tail fibers, too bushy in the tackle, too many legs, that kind of thing. Maybe the body's too fat or something like that. So the shape of the foot is, it is very important as well. And then the color. And, because I don't know how important color is, I don't think it's as important as the shape and the size of the fly, but I'm going to err on the, on the side of caution, and I try to do the, to match the color as closely as I can.
So, do you find yourself more modifying existing patterns? In other words, taking the parachute atoms and tweaking it here and there to try to get a different effect, rather than like starting with a bear hook and trying to create something from scratch.
I think my flies, my patterns have evolved, based on experimentation. It's driven by failure, and so I'm trying a new fly, to hopefully do a better job than the fly that didn't work. And usually it's a fly that did work for a while and it's not working as well. So I'd have to say yes, that, we're modifying and experimenting with the different materials, usually different materials, but, a variety of different little tweaks that we put into it that we hope will accomplish a better result. But that's not to say that there haven't been times when there are instances where something really completely different. And I apply that more into emerging patterns than anything, I've tried to create something that I haven't seen before, whether it's in someone else's tying or in my own. So there is some occasionally or periodically some new thing, at least from my perspective, that comes about when I'm at the vise.
Now, a question came in from Mike Clark in New York. He said, in the past you wrote about using marabou feathers for tying dry flies, and in your latest book, Bush's CDC, without a mention of marabou, has CDC replaced marabou in your arsenal?
Well, I wrote this, the story about marabou, I think certainly in advance of, either my introduction or certainly before I was as familiar with it as I am now. And I wasn't emphasizing marabou as much as having extreme flotational qualities. I was using it as the idea of incorporating into a dry fly as an example of its versatility, how it can be incorporated into a dry fly. But it does, contrary to CDC, it does require some help. So, some applying floatant, to marabou always was something that I understood. And as most people know that have tried CDC, that's not required. So, and also there's been, improvements in the quality and the size of CDC compared to when I first began using it, more than 20 years ago. So, I think that, in a large, for example, let's say a large salmon fly, stone fly, I could still use marabou and get something accomplished that maybe CDC wouldn't, basically because it's more appropriate in the size, for the size of the fly than CDC.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Al in Minnesota, he said, when you're designing a new fly, what's more important, realism or cartooning some important feature to act as a recognition trigger? So there seems to be two distinct schools of thought here, and I was wondering what your take was on that.
I think I understand that question. For most of my life, I've subscribed to the idea that, and I don't mean the ultra-realistic flies that you see in some collections, but I still think that adherence to what I was discussing before when I do tie a fly to accuracy and the proportions, etc. However, I do think that there are there's a case that can be made for, I think, two things that I'm discovering can help to trigger, if you will, for, I don't know if there's a better term, to trigger a response in child. And I think movement in the fly is really important. We don't want rigid, if a fly, you know, a rigid form that drifts without movement, because I think motion, you know, it does signal life. And, you know, if you can get, you know, the materials into your fly, they're going to move with a current, you know, without being necessarily induced to movement by twitching the rod, you know, the fly or using the rod tip to do that. I think you can help yourself. And I also think that there's another case can be made, and a strong case can be made for some flash in the fly. And I'm in the process now of probably completing maybe like third or fourth year of experimenting more in greater depth the idea of incorporating flash into the flies. And I'm mostly talking about subsurface patterns emerging, sunken emergers or nymphs, where particularly in a situation where the hatching or the emerging insects or the presence of drifting insects is especially high, and also where trout are becoming more selective or more astute in their ability to avoid our artificials, and we need to, you know, to find some way to tempt them into taking the fly. So you know, putting a little flash into the fly, a little metallic flash, something like that is something that I believe has merit. So I guess I'm in both classes of that. Those two schools are the same school, if that answers the question.
Right. Now, do you? I know, you know, when we talk about recognition triggers, you know, I think of things like streamers. And you know, things like marabou and seal fur and
right.
stuff that has that real lifelike. And then,
right.
then when you're
right.
talking about these emergers and stuff, you have that lifelike, you know, trigger, I think. What about, is it as much of a case for, you know, you do a lot of dry fly fishing. Is there things you can do to a dry fly to make it more lifelike or living-like?
I think that might be the, you know, the strongest argument that can be made for CDC is that not from an especially realistic result as it's being applied to wings, legs, etc. I think what it has is a more natural texture. CDC is soft. I mean, I've tied with hair, you know, and most of us do. And if we don't tie with it, we fish herring flies. But, you know, it's many times we find that we're getting, we're not hooking fish that appear to have taken the fly. And I'm reasonably convinced, I'm firmly convinced that a rigid fly is going to be less acceptable to a trout after it's actually made the decision to take the fly where it touches the fly, perhaps, and it's just not going to accept it, you know, into its mouth so that it can be, you know, so that it can be hooked. That, I think, is something that we can do. I think more of what I would say you can do to a fly, I would say, you know, to make it more effective and more lifelike, I guess, is to just take really, really careful, take great care, and again, don't overdress the fly. You know, if you can get by with two wraps of hackle or three wraps of hackle, don't go to four or five or six. You know, that, and I think that's a good starting point. And as much as it pains me to say this, many times we refuse to fish a fly because it's difficult to see on the water. And quite frankly, I think, you know, here on the Henry's Fork and a variety of the other rivers, there are plenty of other waters I fish around to have selective trout, and my conclusion is that, you know, we have to accept the fact that we're not always going to be able to clearly see the fly, whether it's because of its size or what, and trying to expect the trout to accept something as food that really is, you know, is too large is I think is a mistake.
Okay. Let's talk about some specific tactics. We've got a bunch of questions here left, and I'm going to have you try to give as short and sweet an answer as you can to these folks so that we can get through as many of them as we can here. But Tom Adams, Charlotte, North Carolina, writes in, on the ranch, and he's talking about Harriman Ranch, how do you cope with the underwater plant growth when nymphing?
Well, I cope with it just like, I guess, like everybody else does. You know, one of the reasons we have such a prolific fishery and the hatches that we enjoy here is because it's a very rich, it's very rich in aquatic plant growth. If you're talking about being able to avoid the aquatic growth when you're fishing a fly, there probably is no real solution that I can provide. I think there is an advantage. I mentioned that, how pleased I was with a Nautilus tapered leader that I can rely on to fish as well as my own knotted tapers. I think if you can get by without using, with as few knots in your leader as possible, that's going to be helpful.
Yeah. But it's just,
it's the nature
deal with it, right?
Unfortunately. And then the other side of it, when you're playing trout, that's an obstacle as well. You have to have some luck, I guess, and you have to have persistence. Just stay with it, and sometimes it's going to work, sometimes it's not.
Okay, we've got Craig in New York writes in, it's because our waters are also pressured here in New York and on the Farmington in Connecticut, many times going small and showing the trout something different in the way of pattern style, something not seen for a while seems to help. Do you find that a similar situation on the Henry's Fork?
Absolutely. Absolutely, I do. I've concluded that, we cannot, and history's proven that to me, that I can come up with a fly that I'm just convinced is going to be the all-time answer to situations of difficulty. And have good success, and gradually, after some time, or after I begin making it available to other fishermen in the area, it does seem to leave it to lose some of its appeal. I'm not saying it becomes worthless, but I think it does make sense to try to show fish something different than they're accustomed to seeing on a regular basis.
Steve Bourne, Madison, Wisconsin. In fact, Steve was a guest.
Oh, Steve, my friend Steve. Okay, great.
Oh, Steve. Steve seems to get around.
He says,
"Hi, Renee. Big Henry's Fork fish are surging and eating something, mostly in the film. No insects are on the surface, and a recent stomach pumping shows fish have been largely eating black midge, pupa, plush larvae. An array of midge patterns, even a small ant, has resulted in failure. Now what? In other words, what does he do now? It's not
catching fish. We're hoping for a quick answer to that. There isn't a quick answer for that, Roger. Usually I think you're going to have to experiment with depth in that situation. Most folks think that they can fish it closer to the surface than maybe it is realistic. Folks on the San Juan know that many times you have to put those midges right down close to the bottom. Here's another thing and again, Steve's a great fisherman, so I don't know if he's teasing me or not.
That's a good question.
It is a great question. But here's what I think is the answer in a nutshell, and this is what I would suggest he tries. This applies to anything when you're having difficulty with this kind of situation, other measures or otherwise. But small insects are attracted to trout as a rule. I'm talking very small insects, and midges usually are in that category. They're attractive only when they're available in large numbers. In other words, a trout isn't going to just randomly pick a midge as it comes by. So I think what we have to commit ourselves to is just staying with it, knowing that there's undoubtedly dozens and dozens of natural insects competing with your fly, and I think many times it's just staying with it, repeated, and hopefully, it's going to fit into the rhythm and in the feeding rhythm of the trout and be what's taken.
Yeah. Well, we need to tie things up here. No pun intended there, but we've run out of time here, Renee. One final question, though, from BG in somewhere in the Rocky Mountains. It says, after all these years, what makes a great day on the water for you these days? Is catching numbers, pulling a fish with a long-time pattern that's still in the works, watching a young student of the sport test his skills and succeeding? So in essence, what turns you on nowadays to fishing?
The numbers game went down the river a long time ago, and the pulling fish with a long-time pattern, I'm happier to find a new pattern that works a little better, and I could put a number of things in the category of special, because I'm a grandfather, I've gone through, you know, teaching my wife to fish when she was a youngster, through my children, through my grandchildren. I have great grandchildren coming up, and a lot of other young kids that. You know, the kids of friends, you know, of friends and coworkers, things like that. I think, you know, seeing a beginning fly fisherman find success, you know, not just on the Henry's Fork, but anywhere is what really, you know, that's what really lifts my spirit in the sport that I love so much.
Great, terrific. Well, stick with me here. Got to wrap things up now, but when we return, we're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, and we'll also be giving away your book, Learning from the Water, which is published by Stackpole Books. So stick with us here for a few more minutes, and we'll get right to that. Family Ties, and that's T-Y-E-S, Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development, and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website at www.familyties.com. That's www.familyties.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. Well, now it's time to give away some of our prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. It's too late now to register, but make sure you do so for our next show because we're always giving away some of these great prizes. If you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show and provide you with information on how to receive your gift. So the first thing we're going to give away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and that's always a good organization to support and be part of. If you don't know anything about them or want to learn more about them, go to www.fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org, and you can learn more about them there. So let's see who our lucky winner of that one-year membership is here, and it's going to be Jay Webster in California. Jay Webster in California. So congratulations, Jay. And if you already have a membership, we'll get you an extension on that as well. And let's see here. Our next drawing will be for a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, and a great magazine out of Calgary, Canada. You can learn more about them at www.flyfusion.com. Mag.com, flyfusionmag.com. And our winner there is Blair Wilding. Blair Wilding in Utah. So congratulations, Blair. I'm sure you'll enjoy that subscription as well. So now, Renee, we're going to give away your book. And the way I do this is pose a question to our live audience only. And whoever answers it correctly first and provides who they are and their location will win the book. So the question would be two parts. What area is two-part question. What is the area that is fly-only on the Henry's Fork, fly-only on the Henry's Fork? And what is Rene's favorite hatch that he likes to fish? Okay? So, oh, that was quick. I think we might have a winner here on the first shot. Rene says your favorite hatch is the Pale Morning Dun and Harriman Ranch as far as the fly only. You got it?
Bingo. Bingo.
Got it. Okay, so Joel Wilson, Sheridan, Wyoming. Joel Wilson in Sheridan, Wyoming. He's not all that far away from you up there, so...
No. We may have even met, so congratulations, Joel.
Yeah, congratulations, Joel. Well, Joel, I've got your email address here, and if you will send me either in the same text box there that you've answered the question in or send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, send me your mailing address and so forth so that we can get Stackpole to send you out this book. And by the way, if you're interested in seeing what else Stackpole has to offer, great fly fishing books, go to www.stackpolebooks.com. That's www.stackpolebooks.com. So, Joel, enjoy and congratulations. It's a beautiful book, by the way, and there's going to be a lot you're going to learn from that. Well, Rene, thanks so much for being on the show tonight. We really appreciate you joining us and taking your valuable time out. And but what better way to spend a nice winter night than talking about fly fishing, right?
Couldn't agree more. I've enjoyed it.
Well, good, good. Good to have you. Our next broadcast will be on January 4th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. And on that show, we're going to interview Rick Haefeli. And our topic for the show will be making the right connection between natural insects and artificial flies. Rick is a retired aquatic biologist and has studied and fly fished freshwater streams and rivers for over 40 years. He's an expert on connecting the dots between the natural world of insects and the artificial world of flies. So listen in to learn how to recognize hatches, pick up the right flies, and be more successful in your favorite trout stream. But we'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Royal Gorge Anglers, and Housatonic River Outfitters, Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska, for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.